Okay, today's talk is given by Dr. Hugh Buchanan, the Secretary of the Boundary Commission for Scotland, Secretariat there. His talk is entitled English Irregular Verbs, I Modernise Parliament, You Gerrymander, He Reviews Constituency Boundaries. The Boundary Commission is responsible for reviews of constituencies and regions of the Scottish Parliament, and also constituencies in Scotland for the Westminster Parliament. And the Commission is an advisory, non-departmental public body sponsored and wholly funded by the Scotland Office. Interestingly, perhaps the Chairman is the Speaker of the House of Commons, although he, as you might expect, takes no part in the proceedings of the Commission. The Commission's work is led by a Deputy Chairman, who is actually a Court of Session judge, appointed by the Lord President of the Court of Session. If you actually know what the various titles are. And two other members are appointed by the Secretary of State for Scotland through our public appointments process. And in addition, and more known to some of you, the Director General of Ordnance Survey and the Register General for Scotland are also ex officio assessors to the Commission. And the Commission is supported in its work by a small secretariat, led of course by Hugh. So over to Hugh.
Thank you very much. So, a title that's longer than it needs to be, but I thought it was more interesting than just saying the work of the Scottish Boundary Commission. Let's jump straight in. You may or may not have seen that before. That is the gerrymander. Invented in the early 19th century in Massachusetts, when in the process of drawing up electoral areas for the US Congress, a set of electoral areas were put to Governor Gerry, Gerry, apparently his name was pronounced, Governor Gerry, who then passed them into legislation. And his political opponents, when satirising his political self-interest in passing that set of boundaries, drew this cartoon showing the set of boundaries characterised as a salamander. So you join Governor Gerry with a salamander and you get gerrymander. So the gerrymander was a creature that became a verb, and the definition is to alter boundaries in order to favour one political party over another. My job is to prevent the existence of the gerrymander. Gerrymandering has become a pejorative verb. It's something that you accuse people of and something that you deny doing. Nobody ever willingly says that they gerrymander. Hence the irregular verb. Nobody admits to gerrymandering. I don't gerrymander, I modernise Parliament. But you gerrymander. So let's just talk a little bit about the House of Commons that we have in the United Kingdom. I'm guessing that we've got a number of people who aren't UK citizens, so I'll recap some things that may be familiar to some, but not to everybody. I'm talking here about the UK Parliament that sits in London. We have a two-house parliamentary system, with the lower house elected, the upper house appointed. More of that at some point in the future, but that's the way it works at the moment. The lower house, the House of Commons, currently comprises 650 members of Parliament, each elected from a single constituency. The division of those across the four home countries of Scotland set out there. Scotland has 59. Those proportions of seats are roughly but not exactly, in proportion to the relative populations of those different parts of the United Kingdom. When you look more closely, it turns out that Wales is significantly overrepresented, Scotland and Northern Ireland slightly overrepresented, and England slightly underrepresented. The electorates, as measured in December last year, the last occasion when there are detailed national consistent statistics available, the electorates in each constituency vary from 40,000 to 87,000. Beyond that range, there are these three notable outliers. So one of the fundamental debates in this area is how much variation there should be. What this is saying is that in some parts of the country, when you cast your vote in the election, there are you and 40,000 other people who cast a vote, or able to cast a vote, and the party attracting the largest number of votes wins, and their Member of Parliament serves that seat for the coming Parliament. Whereas, elsewhere in the country, there are over twice as many people. So, the argument goes, if there's too much variation, then the people in the small constituency individually have much more influence over the political outcome than the people in the large constituency. So there's an argument, quite a good argument, to say that you shouldn't have too much variation in those electorates. These three outliers are all island communities. The first two in Scotland, Nainan and Niar, otherwise known as the Western Isles, and Orkney and Shetland, both very small, very isolated communities, where the decision has been taken that those constituencies should be constituencies despite their very small electorates, because of their isolation and because of their distinctiveness as island communities. By contrast, both geographically and size, the southern tip of England, the Isle of Wight, again, an island community. Because it's an island community, the argument goes they have a shared interest and therefore are best represented in Parliament by a single Member of Parliament. And therefore, even though the electorate is excessively large, we will keep them together in a single constituency. There's not much in common, actually, between the Isle of Wight and Orkney and Shetland. Isle of Wight is within a few miles of the English mainland. You can get there on a ferry any day of the year within half an hour. Orkney and Shetland, as you probably know, take a much, much longer period, and often enough in the winter the ferries don't run at all. So there are great contrasts, but there is a common argument running through that in both cases it's their island nature that means that they need to be treated differently. So if we look at the average electorates of each country, it brings out the fact that I mentioned earlier on, that England has the largest number of electors on average for its constituencies. Wales has definitely the smallest. Scotland and Northern Ireland, somewhere in between. Any particular reason why there should be differences? Well, depends a bit on what you think the nature of the United Kingdom is. There's an argument that says that although our constitution doesn't reflect a federal makeup, there is a federal element to the UK constitution whereby Scotland is an entity in its own right as well as being an entity within the United Kingdom. Similarly, Wales and Northern Ireland. And if you follow that argument through, there's an argument that you can justify some variations in representation for those different countries. That each of these elements, you could argue, needs to have a certain critical mass of representation at the UK Parliament in order to retain its distinctive identity. So, having differences of numbers, it is debatable whether that is wrong or not. And the history shows that in the past that debate has said, no, it is not wrong to have different levels of representation from different parts of the United Kingdom. As I'll explain, the pendulum has swung, and the political view of the current government is that it is wrong to have that variation. So you've got national variations like that. Another interesting way of doing it. Look at the last election. Look at the MPs that were elected from each party. Add up the number of votes that each party got, divide one by the other, and you get these figures. So, each Labour MP was elected on average by 33,359 votes. So they got 33,359 votes. The Conservatives, their nearest rival in terms of national vote share, needed to get an extra 1,600 votes, about 5% extra. why should it take 5% more votes to elect a Conservative MP than a Labour MP? Intuitively you think, that doesn't sound right. Actually, it's much more complicated than that. And there are a whole bunch of reasons why that's different. But politicians, particularly politicians from the government parties, look at these statistics and say, hold on a minute, we've got a problem here, and we've got a problem that affects our self-interest. So maybe we'll develop a policy to do something about it. So Labour, Conservative, small but measurable difference, SNP, Lib Dems, and indeed when you go on to other parties, then you get similarly very large numbers. We have a system that works more or less fairly on a two-party basis, but much less equitably when you go out to a larger number of parties. So that's votes per MP, and you could say, well, it's not right that, depending on which party you're in, you've been supported by a larger number of votes. But as I say, it's not that simple. There are many other measures you could use. And I couldn't find any statistics for these, and I gave up trying to work the statistics out myself. But maybe rather than votes, you should be looking at electors per MP, per party. Because not everybody who's entitled to vote actually votes. Patterns of voting are such that in areas of social deprivation, there tends to be a lower turnout. Those areas tend to return more left-wing MPs than right-wing MPs. So maybe the reason you've got this difference is that the Labour electors don't turn out to vote. Maybe. You need to do a bit more research. So electors per MP, maybe that's actually a better measure. Because once you're an MP, you're not just representing the people who voted for you, you're representing all the electors. Take that a step further. You're not just representing all the electors, you're representing all the population. And there's a big difference, or there are several differences I'll come back to, between electorate and population. So, starting off with some simple facts about our Parliament. Once you start to do the analysis, you can produce statistics to prove a point, but if you stop to think about the statistics and analyse them, they're not as simple as they at first appear. So why some of those variations? Variations in electorate, overrepresentation of Wales, very significantly. Scotland used to be overrepresented at the Parliament until 2005, when, as part of the devolution settlement, the after effects of setting up the Scottish Parliament here in Edinburgh, in 1999, was a reduction in Scotland's representation at the UK Parliament. So at that juncture in 2005, Scotland changed from having 72 members of the Westminster Parliament to 59. A very substantial reduction. But that was seen as being the part of the overall settlement, saying, well, you now deal with so many subject matters at the Scottish Parliament, education, social services, etc., you don't need as many decision makers as part of the London Parliament. That's one variation. Second variation, special geographical considerations. Slightly laboured phrase, but it's a phrase that's used in the legislation. So the legislation sets out that you can have exceptional constituencies where special geographical considerations apply. And that's the justification used for the island constituencies that I mentioned before. Thirdly, and this is something I haven't mentioned before, one of the reasons for the variations is that in designing constituencies in the past, the boundary commissions respected, to a certain extent, local authority boundaries. So, for example, you might come across the city of Glasgow, where you look at the electorate, you do some calculations, and it turns out that the electorate in Glasgow justifies the existence of 4.6 constituencies. What do you do next?
Well, you could... You can't give them 4.6, because you can't have part constituencies. Every constituency has to be whole. So you either give Glasgow 5, because you say, well, Glasgow is an entity, we want MPs that recognise and represent that entity, or you give them 4, or you go over one of the boundaries into one of the neighbouring local authority areas. That was a choice that the Boundary Commissions had. And in the past, the Boundary Commissions gave significant weight to that factor and would take a decision in a case such as that to give a local authority area a whole number of constituencies rather than combining it with one of its neighbours. If you do that, the arithmetic becomes obvious that you're going to end up with a certain degree of variation in the electorate. So some of that variation in the electorate between different constituencies was done deliberately because there was felt to be a need to reflect local authority boundaries as well as simple electorate numbers. Fourth one, electorate increase. The electorate in this country, the United Kingdom that is going up steadily. Almost all of that increase is taking place in England. The electorate in Scotland is static, declining slightly. But the net effect is that English constituencies get bigger. Because during the period or during the lifetime of a constituency, the English electorate keeps driving upwards, the Scottish electorate drifts down, Welsh is fairly static, and so you get further imbalances arising. Hard to solve that. A constituency has a lifespan, and if the distribution of electors around the country is changing during that lifespan, you will get variations arising. Variations in party votes, differential turnout, and I've already mentioned, people in socially deprived areas don't turn out as well. That's one aspect of it. Another aspect is, if you live in a constituency which has always returned an MP from one party, comes to election day, you think, am I going to bother? They'll just get in again. So you don't bother, and they get in again. So there's an incumbency effect. If a constituency has got a substantial majority for one party or another, then supporters of that party tend not to turn out. That's more true of the Labour Party than the Conservative Party. Conservative Party are quite funny, actually. If you talk to local activists, they say, we had an absolutely marvellous time at the last election. We pushed our majority up from 25,000 to 27,000. Didn't we do well? No, you didn't. You completely wasted your time. What you should have done is stop campaigning in your constituency. You had a 25,000 majority. You were never going to lose it. Get on the bus, go and knock on doors in the next constituency and try and win that one. Conservative Party local activists are so proud of their own success that they're not very good at being hard-nosed, win-at-all-cost politicians. Other parties are slightly better at being hard-nosed, win-at-all-cost politicians. So, there's some quite complicated stuff that political scientists study about differential turnout. And Labour do well in Wales. A lot of MPs in Wales are Labour. Therefore, since Wales is electing more MPs than its population would simply justify, then the Labour Party benefit. Okay, let's just mention a little bit about the Boundary Commissions. Four of us, one in each of the four home countries. Why four? Well, you could argue that there should only be one, but being able to have some local knowledge and local accountability is quite an important part of the process. So there are four, have been four for a long time, set up to be politically neutral and independent.
as was mentioned, the Deputy Chairman is a senior judge. I hope you've never met a Court of Session judge, because if you have, you've probably been very, very bad. So you don't want to meet them. They're charming people, brain the size of a planet, but profoundly independent of anybody. You can never tell them what to do or what to think. They'll work it out for themselves. Thank you very much. So that's a great strength. The other commissioners are appointed, selected for their lack of political involvement. Now, you could say, well, if you're trying to keep an eye on politicians, don't you need a little bit of political savvy? Yes, you need a bit of political savvy, but you don't want somebody around the table who, when they walk away from that table, is campaigning for one party or another. You want somebody who distances themselves from those kind of arguments. And there are similar separate bodies that deal with local government boundaries. We deal with boundaries, we don't deal with elections. So we draw constituencies, throw them over the fence, and then they get used in elections. We don't try to anticipate what the electoral outcome will be when we design constituencies, and that's very deliberate. Similarly, we don't look at what electoral outcomes have been when designing constituencies. Non-political membership, independent of government, set up 65 years ago, operating under legislation that was originally put in place 25 years ago, but I'll come back to that because there's a substantial change going on at the moment in the legislation. So, we have a new government as of May this year. And this was an area where both the Conservative Party and the Lib Dems had expressed views in their manifestos. They'd both expressed the view that there were too many MPs. Quite a popular view, because as you'll remember, there's been a lot of trouble in the last year or so about the cost of MPs, the behaviour of MPs. So standing up and saying there are too many of the rogues, we'll do away with some, yeah, quite an attractive policy option. So the two parties that now form the government both went down that road. They looked at the process for reviewing boundaries and said, actually it takes an awful long time, and we've got these electorate changes going on in the midst of it. And so as a result, the constituencies that we're using are kind of out of date before they're used. So for example, the constituencies in England that were contested for the first time in May this year, the design process for those started in the year 2000. So the review took place in 2000 and 2006. When it concluded in 2006, the election had just been passed in 2005. The next general election came along in 2010. So the English constituencies, brand new, based on electorate from 10 years ago. In the meantime, electorate distribution has changed significantly, so you get the same question or the same issue about the variation in electorate. So they wanted shorter reviews, they wanted more equal electorates by making the reviews more frequent, but also emphasising parity. Parity is the technical term for getting the same number of electors in each seat. So the new objective was to tighten up on that requirement, reduce the cost of Parliament, and votes. Every vote should have equal worth. Every vote should have equal worth. Hard to disagree with that statement. You know, it's like disagreeing with democracy. We don't do that in this country. So votes of equal worth is a great rallying cry. But again, it's a little bit more complicated than that, and I'll come back to that later. So, government brought in some legislation, which is currently manoeuvring its way through the House of Lords. It's been through the House of Commons. And this bill says there'll be 600 constituencies in place of 650. Okay, that's interesting. Conservative Party manifesto had said 585. Lib Dem manifesto had said 500, so you split the difference, and you don't get anything like 600. But anyway, 600 is what we've got. Every electorate is to be within 5% of the average, apart from Scottish Islands. So Western Isles, Orkney, and Shetland are different and special. And any constituency bigger than 12,000 square kilometres is special too. This was to deal with the possibility that if you drew a constituency to encompass enough electors in the west of Scotland, you could end up with an absurdly large and unmanageable area. So they set a maximum area limit. Reviews to take place every 5 years, previously it was every 10 or so. No local inquiries, slightly technical part of the process, but I'll come back to that. And then, in addition to the exemption from electorate limits on some size, there's an absolute ceiling on size as well. So that's what they wanted. Aha, said their opponents, you're gerrymandering. Oh, no, 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 we're modernising Parliament. No, you're gerrymandering. So, what were the elements to this accusation of gerrymandering? Why did you pick 600? If you model the change in representation that results from reducing the size of the House of Commons from 650, then you can imagine that as you reduce by one seat each time, that seat has an incumbent, that incumbent belongs to a party, and therefore there is an impact on that party. So some clever academic or party wonk or somebody, I can't remember who, looked at this and said, right, if you go from 650 to 600, then the effect on each of the parties is this. If we went further, the effect would be that. If we went less far, the effect would be the other. And they suggested that one of the reasons that the government had chosen 600 was because they saw party advantage in doing so. That at 600, there was less proportional impact on the government parties than other parties. Second accusation. Again, apologies, because I know you're not all political science students. And you know. Any political science students in the room? No? No? Okay. What's the difference between government and parliament? We have 650 elected MPs. They form the parliament. The largest party or group of parties form the government. The government are the people who actually propose legislation and set the policy agenda. The members of the government are actually selected from the parliament. So you start off with 650, you then appoint a prime minister, a deputy prime minister, a chancellor, a foreign secretary, a home secretary, an undersecretary of this, an undersecretary of that. Turns out you've got about 90 people from the parliament who get picked out and given some job in the government. So you're only left with 560 to keep an eye on them and say, not sure we like what you're doing there. So the accusation here was, if you reduce the total from 650 to 600, suddenly you've got 50 fewer people to do the scrutiny. So there was an accusation that the government, again, was serving its own interests by getting people off its back. Okay, third accusation. The reason that you're setting these exceptions, Orkney and Shetland, Western Isles, very large Highland constituencies, is Orkney and Shetland, oh look, it's got a Lib Dem MP. Very large Highland constituencies, oh look, Lib Dem MPs. Doesn't work with the Western Isles, SNP MP. But the accusation was that the exceptions were being made for party political purposes. Why not, people said, give the same exceptions to the Isle of Wight? Well, I actually got a Conservative MP, so there was no party reason why not, but that didn't happen. What about Cornwall? People in Cornwall got terribly excited. In the past, Cornwall, as a county, was entitled to five or six constituencies. Under the new numbers, it must have been six or seven in the past. It's now going to get 5.5. So it's going to have to share an MP with Devon. Doesn't sound like the end of the world. And the Prime Minister got a bit exasperated with some of this debate and said, for heaven's sake, it's not the Amazon, it's the Tamar. To which the local said, "We know it's not the Amazon, it's much more important than that." Which reminds me of Matt Busby's comment about football. You know, Matt Busby said, "Some people say football's a matter of life and death, but actually it's much more important than that." So, Cornwall, Anglesey. Anyone from North Wales? No? You can spit to Anglesey from the mainland. Many people do. Hardly around the top. And my faith in Parliament was slightly restored when I realised that irony was alive and well when an MP tabled an amendment saying that there should be a constituency for Retford. If you ever take the Edinburgh-London train, you go through Retford at high speed in about 20 seconds flat. There's not much there. But his argument, slightly subtle, was, if you're going to start making exceptions, then where do you stop? If there's something special about anywhere, then Retford's as good as the rest of them. So, in all seriousness, maybe, he tabled an amendment saying Retford has to have its own MP, regardless of its electorate. No local inquiries, another accusation. So I glossed over this before. Process in the past was that the Boundary Commission would think up some ideas, publish them. People would then write in and say what they thought, and if lots of people objected, then you'd have a local inquiry. You get a gathering of people in a room, people can put forward their arguments, a judge sits there and listens, weighs up the relative merits of the arguments and delivers a report. But everybody's had the chance to come along and explain why what is being proposed is wrong. That was what the local inquiry was. Took a good idea, but took a long time. Government proposals remove the local inquiry, and the accusation is that they've done that to avoid scrutiny, to allow proposals that local people won't like to go through unchallenged. So again, suggestion that they were doing it for political purposes. And the final point that people raised, why are you using electorate? There are lots and lots of people who aren't on the electoral roll. Wouldn't it be better to use population? I'm going to dwell on this a bit, because it is quite interesting. Various differences between electorate and population. Electorate doesn't include under 18s. Well, actually, it doesn't. It does. There are lots of 17-year-olds on the register, because the technical definition for this purpose includes people who will be 18 by the time the next register is compiled. So if you're 17, you can be on the electoral register. If the election happens tomorrow, you don't get to vote, but at some point, you'll become 18. So, children in general, foreign nationals, people who haven't bothered to register, people who just moved home and have forgotten to re-register, lords, and topical, because it's about to change, but those serving prison sentences. If you're in prison, if you've got a custodial sentence at the moment, you don't vote. You're about to get the vote. Add those up, and there's probably about a 20% difference between electorate and population. But more importantly, there's a variable difference. And when you go to inner city areas, the difference is much larger. Let me ask you a question. Four possible answers. I'll get you to put your hands up in a moment to one of the four possible answers. The simple question, are you on the electoral register in the United Kingdom? Okay? And I'm interested in the answer. So the possible answer is no. So either you've never got around to explain the answers and then come back. No, so you've never got around to it, or you're not entitled to because you're a foreign national or whatever. Yes. Obvious. More than once. If you're a student, you could be registered here and your parents could have registered you at home. Perfectly legitimate, no problem. Don't worry, the police will not come crashing through the door if you put your hand up to that question. If you've got a holiday home, again, perfectly legitimate to be on the register more than once. Because when the election happens, who knows which of your two legitimate homes you'll be occupying. So it's perfectly legitimate to be on the register more than once. Voting twice in the same election is, however, I should warn you, a criminal offence.
finally, don't know. Okay, so let's run through. Are you on the electoral register? Who knows that they're not on the electoral register? One, two, three, four. Okay, fine, thank you. Who knows they're on the electoral register once? It's 18, I think, right? Who knows they're on the electoral register more than once? And who doesn't know? Ah, well, you're either very confident or you're shy about admitting. There's nothing wrong with not knowing, actually. Because we have in this country a system of head of household registration. Once a year, the electoral registration officer writes to every household, and the head of the household has to then fill in a form saying, who are the people who are eligible to vote at that house? Now, anybody who lives with anybody else can imagine the fun and games you have about deciding who's head of household. And particularly if you're in a student shared flat, then a bit of paper comes in through the post, might get answered, somebody might pick it up, somebody might put it in with the double glazing adverts or the Indian takeaway adverts. But it means that although technically it's an obligation to register, it's actually impossible to enforce. Because all you have to do is turn up and say, well, I'm not the head of household, so it's not my fault that I'm not registered. So it's in process to replace that with individual voter registration, where we will each be asked individually to fill in the form and send it back. So the whole question of electorates is much more complicated than you at first realise. Right, so that's what the government's trying to do. Will they succeed? I don't know. What the legislation will do is it will reduce the variation in constituency electorates. Because the law says when the Boundary Commission proposes constituencies, they all have to be within 5% of the average, with these very small number of exceptions. So that's going to be a change from what's gone before. Much narrower ranges of electorates. Secondly, you will have more frequent reviews, because again, the law says that the Boundary Commission has to do this job every 5 years rather than every 10 years. And therefore, the data that's being used to compile constituencies will be much more recent and more accurate, better reflection of the current situation. But it won't remove party differential votes for seats. All that stuff I was referring to before of, well, that party always get in here, so there's no point in getting out to vote. That won't change. All that stuff about social deprivation and patterns of voting in socially deprived areas, that won't change. So you'll still get these differentials in party votes per seat. Not sure that the government parties fully understand that yet. They look back at those statistics I showed you earlier on that say that it takes an extra 1,600 votes for a Conservative to be elected compared to a Labour MP, and they think that's going to completely disappear. It won't. Promise. It probably will get better. You still won't get perfect electoral parity. You'll still get some big constituencies and some weak constituencies. More because of this change of electorate than because of the design. So the design will constrain it quite tightly, but you'll still get lots of migrants coming in and settling in some areas. You'll still get lots, you get periodic student populations moving in and out of areas. So depending on when you measure and when the election takes place. And it won't prevent ineffective votes in safe seats. So this idea that every vote will have the same weight is far too simplistic. Because the weight of your vote really depends on the marginality of your seat. If you live in a seat where the MP had a majority of 50 last time, you've got real power. You've got real power. If the last time the MP had a majority of 20,000, stay in bed. No, don't. I didn't know. But the effect the electoral effect of staying in bed will be zero. I still think you have a civic duty to go out and vote, but the effect of doing so will be unmeasurable. Whereas in the seat where the majority was 50, you could change the world. So, there are some things that this legislation will resolve, that will deliver government policy. There are some things that this will not do, which the government would like to do, but the legislation will never be able to do that. There are different party agendas going on here, of course. The Lib Dem answer to that final point is that they would like to move to a proportional voting system for MPs, so that the whole concept of a safe seat changes, so that in the same way as we have for regions in the Scottish Parliament, or for members of the European Parliament, you assign the seats to the votes in a proportional fashion rather than the first-past-the-post fashion. So, the policy will achieve some, the legislation will achieve some policy objectives, but there will be some risks to public perception of politics. I suppose the starting point was the government is trying to improve public perception of the political process by improving the connection between voters and their MPs. But it won't necessarily work because you have this very tight constraint on the number of electors in a seat, but people keep moving around. It's going to mean a lot of continuous change to constituencies. So the ability of residents to say with confidence, I'm in this constituency and this is my MP, will be eroded. Because you're going to move constituencies much more often than you did in the past. And that's going to be a problem. It's also going to be a problem for the political parties, because they have their local activists, the people who put together those leaflets and knock on doors and phone up and put adverts in the paper and all the rest. And they're going to be disrupted by that same process of change. So there is going to be some damage or some threat to the political life of us. Secondly, you're going to get less coterminosity. Horrible technical term. Coterminosity is where two things end at the same place. And it generally makes life easy. If you know that at the edge of Edinburgh you leave one constituency and go into another, you can just about cope with that. But if there's a little bit that's shared across the boundary into East Lothian or Mid Lothian, then people will tend to get a bit mixed up about that. And that will happen more with these proposals. And possibly there'll be a lack of confidence because this local inquiry process where anybody can turn up and say their piece as part of the process will disappear. We'll have to wait and see whether those risks are significant or not. Whether in 5 or 10 years' time people say, you see that 2010 legislation, that was, with hindsight, a good thing or a bad thing. A couple of bits about maps, how do we do our job? Fairly simple in GIS terms. Lots of background maps. Unit postcode polygons, that's a key one. Electorate data, that's a key one. Some current and historical boundaries. So, this image combines those two key data sets. Postcode polygons, General Register Office for Scotland, hand digitise, unit postcode polygons for all of Scotland. God bless them. They keep trying to stop, but the whole public sector uses this data set endlessly, so they're locked in, they can't stop. They update it every 6 months and reassure it, and it's a real national asset. That's what those polygons are. The electoral register. So when you register to vote, your name and address goes onto the electoral register. We get supplied that data on an annual basis. The first thing we do is we take your name off it. We're not interested in your name. We are very interested in your address and specifically your postcode. So we aggregate the count, or we calculate the count of electors per postcode over all of Scotland. We then do a join between that and the postcode polygons, and allows us to produce
maps like that. So the shading is reflecting the number of electors per postcode. There's a couple of anomalies. That very dark polygon in the air in the middle. I don't know what that's doing there. It's a little place called Moodysburn, I think, on the edge of Glasgow. I don't think there are that many electors in that postcode. I think there's an anomaly in the data set when this map was drawn. But that's our bread and butter. We're looking across all of Scotland. We're drawing polygons that we think will make good constituencies, and we need to know the number of electors in them. So, copy of ARC, this data set, Bob's your uncle. Postcodes are essential for counting electorate accurately, or rather, counting electorate precisely, which may or may not be accurate. You can pick that up in a seminar. But they're actually rubbish as being boundaries. So the ages of postcodes tend to be, well, unpredictable. They will cross roads and take in a house on the other side, just because of the way that's the post office works. So when we can't simply use postcodes as our boundaries, we use them as a tool for counting the people within those boundaries. And then we have to revisit the boundaries and say, doesn't make sense for that house on the other side of the road to be in with these ones. We're going to draw the constituency boundary down the middle of the road instead. We do that. All sorts of things like that. Simple raster background with a map with a line on it showing where we're drawing a boundary. There's a little bit of technicality here. I said before that constituencies were shared out between the different parts of the United Kingdom proportionally. That's fine, you all thought. I know what proportionally means, equal shares. Yeah, it's actually a little bit more complicated than that. And if you've got a mathematical inclination, it gets quite interesting. Take the number of electors, divide by 598, which is the number of constituencies apart from the special ones, and you get a magic number of the average number of electors in each seat. Then I have to divvy them up. But you use something called Sam-Langway, which takes the electorate, divides it by 2 times the number of constituencies you've already got in that country, plus 1. Looks weird. It is a bit weird. But it actually works, and you end up with a proportional number of constituencies in each country. Why do they say that rather than just say proportionally? Well, if you just said proportionally, you might end up with fractional entitlements that didn't work. So that England might be due 502.6, Scotland might be due 49.6, Wales might be due 31.6, Ireland might be due 18.6. Round them all up, and you don't end up with the number you need. So what Sam-Langway does is it gives you a method of avoiding that kind of rounding dispute. I was quite impressed when I saw the bill and saw they put this bit of maths in. It wasn't a bit of maths I'd ever come across before. One of the very few occasions when you ever see parliamentary legislation with an equation in it. So you divvy up the number of constituencies, we repeat the process of allocation within Scotland and say, right, we'll look at local authorities, we'll lump those together and allocate that way. We'll look for effective boundaries, major roads and rivers, wars and settlements, and we do the counting of the land. The press have some fun. Those of you of a certain age will remember the Smash adverts. Smash is a horrible dried potato product from the 1970s. And they had adverts of little aliens who were commenting on how strange life was on Earth. And they would, you know, they would find something like a packet of dried a potato and say, oh, it's ridiculous. They would peel the skin off and they would boil it and then they would eat it. Well, now we have Smash. And the little aliens would fall around on their backs, you know, giggling manically. Well, one of my minor claims to fame, my Andy Warhol 15 minutes, is
Whereas this guy in the mirror, when we were doing a previous review, likened me to a little smashed alien. Because he said, I don't know this guy. I bet he's rolling around in his office, laughing his head off at all the discomfort he's causing these MPs.
So the press have a field day. The political parties have a field day. The political parties use the press to generate the coverage that they want. And we smile quietly and walk away. We've just done the job, finished earlier this year, for the Scottish Parliament. What I've been describing to you is a process for the Westminster Parliament. It's a bit different. The Scottish Parliament process, instead of just this primary rule of electorate, we had four rules and we had to work out the balance between electorate, local authority boundaries, geography and local ties. We had these local inquiries. We only do that job every 10 years or so. It will be an interesting compare and contrast exercise to see how well each one works. And that's it. I'll stop talking and invite questions.
Thank you very much. You had an interesting talk. Lots of questions for the people outside. They're usually Labour, actually, but the people outside the polling station. Wind them up. And I should say, actually, I first visited Retford, actually, having passed through it for many years last year, and I thought it was lovely. It's a supermarket square. It's fully deserving of its MP. Anyway, more seriously, any serious questions? William's in there.
Do you ever look at other countries' electoral systems as a way of trying to think very differently about how you do this, or do you think you are just the masters of Europe in terms of how you do it?
It's not so much that we're the masters of Europe, but we are the servants of Parliament. So we are given legislation that specifies how we do our job. The Boundary Commission has quite a narrow scope. Its scope is to recommend what constituencies should be. It doesn't actually have a scope to recommend how boundaries should be drawn. Which there is an argument that would say that because we've done it, we've seen it work or not work. But Parliament hasn't thought fit to give us the task of advising them. They've preserved that right for themselves. When you look around Europe, or look around the world, we are unusual in having a first-past-the-post system. The only countries that have first-past-the-post system are this one and its former colonies, by which I include the United States. So it's a British mindset that we've had for a long time that many other people have never shared. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to think over.
Here's not a question, it's really just a request that you maybe talk a bit more about process in relation to something in the last question, which is the actual drawing of the boundaries. You know, you actually showed a boundary in one of your slides there, but I guess it's an indicative boundary, but you may want to just explain how we actually get to our boundary for a constituency. That's the one.
Yeah. Yes.
Hang on, you're going to have to point to where the boundary is, because I can't see it.
It's a masterpiece of bad map design. So the grey and white line going up here through the raster.
That line is indicative. When we finish the process, we align our boundaries with master map, with Ordnance Survey master map. So we snap to roads, fences, rivers,
We certainly avoid going through buildings where at all possible, but of course people build things after we've been along, so we can't future-proof them entirely. So we end up with a line that fits with the national topography. We then provide that line to Ordnance Survey, who quality assure it, incorporate it into their products, and away they go. But actually, when we're drawing that line, a lot of the time we're not drawing it from first principles. Instead, we're tracing off something else. So this might follow an existing ward boundary, or it might follow an existing constituency boundary, or it might follow a local authority boundary. So wherever possible, no, not wherever possible. In many cases, we will be following something that already exists. And you get to a point like that, you think, well, why is it doing that? And probably the answer is that something else did that before. And so, for the handful of people who live here, the disruption of saying, actually, you're no longer in Edinburgh West, you're in Edinburgh South, you think, well, is that disruption worth it? It doesn't look very tidy on the map, but at the end of the day, does it matter? If that household has always known that it's in Edinburgh West, then leave them in Edinburgh West. So there's a sociological aspect to it. It's not purely a technical drawing a precise line on a map. Is that the sort of thing you were interested in?
You actually touched on the very question I was going to ask you, which is what happens once you've drawn that boundary and a developer comes along and builds a house that sits on that boundary, which is presumably entirely possible. Who makes the decision as to?
The electoral registration officer.
All right.
So in every local authority, there are 15 electoral registration officers around the country who are responsible for taking the forms, determining your eligibility to vote, and adding you to the register. And in a case where your house straddles the boundary, it's their responsibility to decide. We do have the power to do an interim review, but the only times that the Commission does so is where a local authority boundary has been changed. So say, for example, I know this is not the case, but this was the Edinburgh City boundary and it got moved from there to there, then the Commission might come on and say, actually, there's quite a lot of people in there, let's tidy up. The Commission would never go through that whole lengthy process just for a handful of people. EROs are very important individuals in this process. And they're the ones who, for example, will have to deal with prisoners and making sure they're on the electoral register. In their homes, where they lived before they got imprisoned, not in the address of where they are imprisoned.
Which means they're not a prison.
Yes. Yeah, well, I thought that one. You know, still there's a lawyer in the room, can't
you? There's one from Bob and then back to the...
Yeah,
I come to this from a background of being involved with spatial optimizing algorithms, where you're trying to draw, where you optimize catchment areas for service centers or locate service centers. And there's a kind of relationship with districting algorithms, where you're trying to get the computer out of the mathematical optimization process to generate constituencies that are equal. Mm. Now, as I understand it, those algorithms are now used quite a lot in the United States because they're very strong on equality of constituencies. Yeah. I think it's only 1% deviation.
I don't know the details, but
so
I know it's very...
It's less than 5%. And I'm completely intrigued. I mean, I'd love to watch... You're not using the computer for this purpose.
No.
But I'd love to watch how you come up with these... districts and electoral districts in this kind of ad hoc way. I mean, it may be at the end of the day, it may be better in lots of ways in a computer algorithm, because I guess what's happening is instinctively you're digesting a lot of information, the ward boundaries, the local authority boundaries. what your previous constituency were, so it may be a more subtle outcome. But I just wonder, now that GIS systems are so terrific and computers are so fast, and there may even be districting algorithms in that are readily obtainable.
Yeah, no, there are.
It would be possible to input a lot of your data. I don't know if they could always take account of giving some weight to the existing constituency boundaries and ward boundaries and so on.
Yes.
It would be possible to input your data and say for a particular city, Glasgow, we maybe got to find five constituencies, to get the algorithms to generate not just one solution, but several. Because the great thing about algorithms is if you give them different starting points, or you kick them off in different ways, you get different outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And you could then get different outcomes, say five different, 10 different outcomes for equal constituencies in Glasgow, possibly respecting most of your criteria, and you could then evaluate that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, now, I think this was done in the United States, they're then evaluated in terms of party advantages by the parties. And maybe it's easier in the United States because you've got two parties. Right here, whereas
yeah.
Scotland, we've got a four-party system, and then a three-party system. So, I just kind of wondering if I'm not au fait with the state of the art in electoral districting algorithms.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be a very interesting experiment. The Commission is aware that a technological solution exists, that this software is available. But the exercise we're engaged in is only partly a technical exercise. It's also an exercise in retaining the confidence of political parties and electors. And I think if you were going to use an automated approach, you would have a harder job to retain the confidence of local people, that you weren't, to quote a phrase, playing a numbers game. One of the common accusations that is always thrown at the commissions is that we're not properly reflecting local interests, that instead we're just playing a numbers game. And taking a programmatic approach to generating solutions would, I think, strengthen that accusation.
Well, the counter-argument to that is that maybe, say for Glasgow, drive five constituencies, a computer could generate maybe 20 good solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're possibly picking one of those solutions, and maybe you're picking one of the more biased solutions, because you don't know what other solutions are like.
Biased in the sense of
party advantage.
But remember, we don't look at electoral data. Elections data.
But that means that you're possibly blind to the fact then that some of the solutions you're producing have party advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you generated 20 and then you evaluate them, feed in the voting data as they do in the United States, you can find which are the least biased in terms of party advantage.
Which is not a trivial question, because first of all, you would need to define what party advantage was, and actually before that, you would have to redefine the role of the commissions. The commissions are set up to be non-partisan, whereas the approach you're describing is a bipartisan approach, which, as you note, in this country would have to be a multi-partisan approach. There's a fundamental philosophical difference there between a non-partisan approach and a multi-partisan approach. And the UK system that has largely worked well has been for a non-partisan approach. So there's that precursor. But the second point I was making, even once you go to a partisan approach, I'm not sure that there is uniform agreement on what constitutes non-bias if you're operating within a first-past-the-post system. The Commission's view would be that there is no such thing as a Labour voter, and there is no such thing as an SNP voter. There is a voter, and it is then for the political parties to determine the voting intentions of that voter.
Well, I still come back to the point that the solution you're coming up with has a party advantage, and you don't know what it is, so you're ignoring the really one of the most important things in the whole process. And I mean, one, perhaps the evidence of that, I mean, there have been elections, general elections in Britain, where the party at the national level that got most votes got fewer seats than the other one. For example, in 1951, Labour got significantly more votes than the Conservatives, but the Conservatives got more MPs in Westminster.
Yep.
And that's because, I mean, that's sort of connected with the fact.
Well, but again, it's not that simple. You said that's because, and then you stopped, and I'm glad you stopped, because I think the next bit of your sentence is where the controversy would start. Because what constitutes, well, there's a presumption in your question that popular vote should determine government. It ain't necessarily so. Distribution of votes may have a factor. Wider social factors may play a part. So I don't think there are simple answers that are universally agreed to some of the questions that you're posing. The other thing I should mention is the consultative element of the boundary making process. So the Commission comes up with some proposals, publish them for consultation, hear what's said. And that's a terribly informative process. Most of the answers that we get back are from political parties or from those with party political affiliations. And they are very good at discerning the party advantage or disadvantage that you're describing. And if the Commission, or when the Commission is looking at the representations it receives, it is alive to the party affiliation of those representations and forms a judgment taking that into account. And that is sometimes useful in discerning and correcting some of the elements of bias that you're referring to.
Right. Can I add to that? There's also the issue in the States, is a two-party system, and you have registered of Democrats and registered of Republicans. So you don't actually have the election data in the UK is to on that level of granularity. It's only the parties that have actually got that data. So you can actually have that kind of link, very difficult to have that kind of approach in the UK, because the list of registered Republicans and registered Democrats is a public list in the UK. But what happened in the Scottish Parliament, one of the consequences of the Scottish Parliament elections in 2007 being counted electronically, was that there was data which released from all the polling stations. But with that exception, the only granularity you would have in the UK, in Scotland, would be wards and wards and now just the subject that you can draw it on that basis. And with when it's not a two-party system, it's a lot more difficult to try and draw on that kind of
for the longer term. I mean, we could have finer data on the patterns of voting if each polling station, if the pattern of votes in each polling station was recorded and noted.
But it would be a change. It'd be a change in the constitutional settlement if you moved to designing on that basis. And I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's a big question that the civic society would have to discuss.
And of course, in Britain, we don't like change.
No, we don't.
Nobody does.
One more then from Bruce.
I was just wondering, especially with your sort of past career history, this is a bit of a naughty question. We're terrible for moving boundaries in the UK, and okay, in this situation you've got to move them, but of course from the academic perspective it makes it completely impossible to compare statistics over time. Do you ever think about this, or you just say, oh, I've got to do it, it's got to move? Are there ways you could think of, I guess in a more constructive way of asking the question, are there ways you could think of that could mitigate that problem?
It's a factor, but it's not a major factor. As I was saying before, the Commissioner's job is to implement the law. The law makes some allowance for trying to avoid changing constituencies, but it's not given a great deal of weight in amongst the other factors. And yeah, I think the convenience of academic analysts is not high in the list of political priorities. I do think that this pendulum of how much weight you give to electoral parity swings over time. And if you go back to the 1832 Reform Act, the abolition of the rotten boroughs, it had swung way off the end of the scale in one direction, where you had handfuls of people in Retford returning two MPs, actually. Retford had two MPs. And at that point, the concept was that an MP represented a community. It wasn't given much weight whether that community was of a handful of people or whether it was a city. The point was that the MP represented the community. So at that point, the emphasis was on representing the community, and some people were disenfranchised and some people had enormous power because effectively they could personally appoint an MP. We've now gone to the other extreme, where parity seems to be everything. Trying to get the same number of electors in every area is paramount, and the weight given to community ties, the recognition that there is something about Linlithgow that means you shouldn't divide it between two different constituencies, is getting lost. And as a consequence of the new legislation, there will be cases around Scotland where small towns will end up split between two constituencies simply because the numbers have been given such weight. So I think that pendulum has swung past the optimal position. When it swings back the other way, then arguments for continuity become much stronger. But because of where it is at the moment, continuity, I'm afraid, hasn't really got much of a leg to stand on.
On that note, I think perhaps thanks to Hugh for the blockbuster session. What was it, 20 to 6? So I think we'll retire to the TV at Library Bar. And hopefully I can join you. I have to rush off, actually, and do a show. There is a line in there about our esteemed First Minister and something about 500 pies. So it's good to see there's a political element to that, too. But hopefully I can join you for one. So we'll head to Teviot, and perhaps we can raise a few of these thorny issues with you. Buy him a few sips of his pint as well. But thanks again, and thanks to...
I haven't kept you from your studies too long.